call the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources to order. Today is Tuesday, March 21st. Sorry for being a little bit tardy. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3149 and ask Rep. Brock Smith, Commissioner Mark Lapphart, and Representative David Gomberg to join us at the dais. Okay, gentlemen, tell us what we need to know.
Good morning, Chair Clem, committee. We're here to support House Bill 3149, which is the Oregon Coast Trail Bill. This bill would look at finishing the rest of the miles, roughly, 47 miles of the whole 367-mile coast trail that spans from Astoria down to Brookings Harbor. It is a especially significant considering this year is the 50th anniversary of the Oregon Beach Bill. And I'm going to keep it short so as my colleagues and, of course, Dan and Connie can come up and give you some more information. So I humbly request your support.
And you like the amendment as well?
Correct.
Okay. Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast, a huge chunk of what I hope will soon be the Oregon Coast Trail. And yes, it is indeed the 50th anniversary of the Oregon Beach Bill, so a great time to talk about enjoying the wonders of Oregon's magnificent coastline. And the way we do that is we get people out there experiencing it up close and personal. And we've got a trail that stretches the greater part of the coast. We're trying to close a couple of gaps. That's really what we're talking about here, but I think we're talking actually about much more than hiking the coastline. And many of you may have, like myself, seen the film Wild, which talks about hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. And I was inspired by that, but what we have here is a little bit different, because we're talking about turning people loose on the Oregon coast without tents, without sleeping bags, without stoves. They're essentially hiking from town to town, village to village, and spending money as they go. So this is not just about outdoor recreation. It's not just about celebrating our remarkable coastline. It's also about enhancing our local economies, and I think that's a very important part of what we're talking about here. So I'm going to turn the microphone over to the experts, but I'm very pleased to be here with Representative Brock Smith to present what I think is an important, innovative, and celebratory opportunity for all of us, again, to take advantage of the remarkable coastline here, to make it available to a lot more people, and to also enhance our economies as we go. I might close, Mr. Chair, with just a quick anecdote, if I may. I used to walk part of this trail myself from my office in Lincoln City back to my house until one day somebody leaned out the window, having just finished lunch, I think, at Skipper's, and took what was left of their tartar sauce and lobbed it out the window, and I walked the rest of the way home dripping with tartar sauce on August afternoon, which convinced me that it's important to get people off the highway and onto our trails. You know, one part of the existing hike that is not part of the trail we want to complete is through a tunnel in southern Oregon. It's through a dark tunnel, and there's no walking space on the side, and I've read anecdotes there of people actually taking turns that hiking through while their partners will set up warning stations at the entrance to the tunnel so that vehicles entering will know that there's pedestrians inside. So this has a safety element to it as well, tartar sauce aside. I'm going to turn to Commissioner Lapphart at this point, but I thank you for your consideration, and like Representative Brock Smith, we urge this measure to move forward. Thank you.
Chair Clem, for the record, just to clarify, I'm a retired county commissioner. I just retired after 12 years. I've had the privilege of serving as a Tillamook County commissioner for 12 years. So just to clarify that, I'm not a commissioner right at this moment in time. But I drove over from Sisters this morning to be here to testify in support of this bill. It tells you how important I think it is. And I'd like to first acknowledge the leadership of Representative Smith and Representative Gomberg, who are championing this bill and who are taking the lead in it. And also Representative Witt is also a signer on this, as well as Senator Roblin and Senator Hansel. So hopefully you will give this some very due consideration in moving this bill forward. The 50th anniversary of the Beach Bill, if you read the history of the Beach Bill, it was very controversial. It almost didn't pass. And there was some great leadership provided by the legislature in passing that bill, and it's one of the best things that's ever happened to Oregon is the public access to our beaches. It was a difficult process. I hope that this process of completing the Oregon Coast Trail is not as difficult as the Beach Bill got through. This is a pretty much a win-win. This is a motherhood and apple pie bill. It is good for Oregon to complete the segments. My records show that there's about 382 miles, of which there are 31 gaps yet to be completed, and about 48 miles, as Representative Smith said. This bill requires the development of a plan to complete those segments. The plan is required, and this is important. The plan is required to ensure that these new segments will not conflict with surrounding private property rights, the rights of way, and easements. And that is very important for those people who might be potentially impacted by this. OPRD, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, stated that in 2015, in the first seven months, there were 16.2 million people that visited state parks. 16.2. Dean Runyon estimates in 2015 the direct travel spending, the economic benefits along the Oregon coast, the South Coast was $769 million of people visiting the Oregon coast. Central Coast, $717 million economic benefit. North Coast, $769 million. And that's all, that's motels, that's everything. The National Coast Trail Association estimates that several hundred thousand people walk portions of the trail. Now, the clinker in this bill is it has a little statement in there that talks about funding, and it might have to go to Ways and Means for funding. Clearly, we don't think so. We want to raise the funds through grants, donations, to raise the funds to deposit into the state parks accounts to provide funding for state parks to do this plan. We are not asking for general fund. There, if you read the bill, there is no general fund being asked for to fund this. I think state parks is worried that there could be some funding issues there. The intent is for us to raise the funding, the counties to contribute through their transient lodging tax, foundations, others. I think there's a lot of people out there that when we talk about we need to complete the Oregon Coast Trail, that there will be dollars available to do that. And I can tell you that the amendment is supported. So yeah, I'd be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions for these gentlemen? Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You.
Thank you.
All right, let me call up Connie Soper, Dan Hilburn, and maybe Walt Schroeder. They want to go together. I think Walt used to be a lettuce slider.
He did.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. You sure I'm on the right track here?
Yep. I skipped over three people to get to you.
He's the former Ryan Krieger.
We try to give our former colleagues some sort of benefits. Welcome. Connie, I've got you.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. I'm Connie Soper. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3149, and I wanted to give you a brief overview of the Oregon Coast Trail and why we are supporting this particular bill. The Oregon Coast Trail, as you've heard from previous speakers, is a 372-mile trail that starts at the Columbia River to the north and extends all the way to the California border. The Oregon Coast Trail was first established as an official trail over 40 years ago, but it's still a work in progress because there are gaps that require hikers to walk along the shoulder of U.S. Highway 101, which is an arrangement that is neither scenic nor safe. It's managed by the Oregon State Parks and Recreation Department. Most of the trail is on our public beaches, but there are also sections of the trail that wind over headlands and capes and through state parks. And most of the gaps are outside the jurisdiction of the Oregon Parks Department. I first became interested in the Oregon Coast Trail when I hiked the entire trail about 10 years ago. And I was also really inspired by my experience at the beauty and the appreciation of our public beaches. I wrote a book about the Oregon Coast Trail called Exploring the Oregon Coast Trail, which is a guide for people who do want to hike the entire trail, but it also points out some of the history and appreciation of our public beaches, especially compared to other states. We don't have any fences or barriers or signs telling people to not trespass on our beaches. Other sections of it go through state parks, such as this section in Humbug Mountain State Park. And one thing that's really special about the Oregon Coast Trail is that it does take people by foot through some of Oregon's coastal communities, including Yahats. This is a picture of entering Yahats via the historic 804 trail. One of the special things to me about hiking the trail was a chance to experience more personally some of the Oregon coastal history. Hikers will walk right past shipwrecks and lighthouses and over the same trail used by members of the Lewis and Clark expedition over Tillamook Head. Hikers will walk on bridges, beautiful bridges designed by Condé McCullough in the 1930s. It traverses the historic 804 trail in Yahats, and there are many places of significance of the coastal tribes, including Amanda's Trail on Cape Perpetua, which is has a long history of interest to the tribes. Unfortunately, there are some sections that require people to walk along the highway. These are a couple of photographs showing that the shoulder can sometimes be narrow with a lot of traffic coming at 55 miles an hour or more. At times, the vegetation is not cleared on the guardrail and makes it impossible for a very pleasant experience. So some of the benefits to completing the trail would be that it would greatly improve safety for hikers. It would allow for village-to-village walking so that people who are interested in walking the entire trail or portions of it could do so without having to camp or have a car, because they could just walk from town to town where they are likely to arrange for lodging, meals, and other amenities. This would provide great economic benefit to some of the local coastal communities. I think that increased visibility and interest in the Oregon Coast Trail would attract more visitors, and it would provide enhanced recreational opportunities for visitors and residents alike. One last point I want to make is that we realize that our work will not be done with the passage of this bill. The bill calls for the completion of an action plan, which will identify steps needed to complete the trail. But as was mentioned by previous speakers, there's no funding associated with this bill. There are grants and other opportunities to apply for funds that are competitive in nature, but I think there are opportunities to receive funding for it. This is an important step that would provide a comprehensive and coordinated approach for addressing some of the trail gaps. It would provide a framework to encourage potential funders by raising the awareness of it. It would promote interagency collaboration, especially between the Department of Transportation and Oregon State Parks, but also local jurisdictions such as counties and probably the U.S. Forest Service. It would ensure that mutual goals and objectives are being addressed, and it would position the projects well to compete for grant funding. Hopefully this action plan could be considered a toolkit to really help local jurisdictions successfully apply for grant funding. So that completes my presentation, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Hello. For the record, my name's Dan Hilburn. I live in Salem. I'm retired. I like to hike. I love to walk on the beach. And ever since I heard Connie give a lecture on the Oregon Coast Trail, I've been enamored of the idea of thru-hiking the Oregon Coast. But before anyone can do that, can we change this to slideshow mode? We've got some gaps that we need to close. As you can see there, they're scattered up and down the coast. They're not very big. It amounts to about 15% of the trail that isn't complete. Connie, can you pass me there? Ideally, we'd like to have forest trails like this connecting all the gaps, and I have no doubt that if the entire coast was a state park, we'd already have this. But, of course, the entire coast isn't a state park. There are towns and cities, there's private property, there's businesses, there's rivers and mountains and cliffs. In short, it's complicated. Luckily, the state does have a right-of-way the entire length of the coast, which spans all the remaining gaps. And that's Highway 101. It's our biggest problem, but it's also our ace in the hole. And I want to show you a series of slides from other trails not in Oregon where they have similar challenges, and they've met them in the ways that I'd like to show you. This is a trail which comes right through a town, and there's private property on both sides. After the sidewalk ends, the trail just continues outside the guardrail, and the separating the hikers from the cars. This is a scenic valley, very popular with cars and hikers. There's a river right here, no room for a trail on the cliffs, but they've set up a barrier there to keep the hikers safe and the cars separate. Here's a quiet country road where a low curb does the same thing, and on the right-hand side, this is a pedestrian underpass. Oops, sorry there, I'm getting ahead of myself. A pedestrian underpass, which is much preferable to what we use on the Oregon Highway 101 right now, which is wait for a gap in the traffic and then run for your life. Bridges are a pinch point and hard for pedestrians. On the left-hand side here, a stripe of paint doesn't offer much safety, but on the right-hand side, a little lane like that makes all the difference in the world. I want to now show you how those could apply in Oregon. This is our longest gap. It's Humbug Mountain, 11 miles of hiking on the highway right now. And in the connection strategy that Parks put together in 2011, they identify several options. One would be to continue the trail that goes over the mountain to the beach. That would be nice. Or if that doesn't work, something outside the guardrail here would keep the hikers separate. And once you get to here, there's another right-of-way from the old coast highway, which would make a nice trail, but you probably need a pedestrian underpass right there. This is the gap between Neskowin and Lincoln City. It's a little more complicated. The beach ends here. There used to be a trail which goes up to the top of Cascade Head. We ought to explore seeing if that could be reopened. If not, then hiking along the highway here needs to be improved because it's very dangerous right now. Down here, the second piece of this, we have the Salmon River. We have to get people across there, but then it would be awfully nice to get them to the Road's End Beach right there. And this is all Forest Service land. There's a city-owned piece here and some private property, so we should explore whether that's possible. If not, we need to improve the hiking along the highway to get folks safely into Lincoln City. In the connection strategy, the goal of finishing the trail is 2021. That's a pretty ambitious goal, but I think it's attainable if we get ODOT working with state parks, if we get an action plan which identifies exactly what needs to be done and how much it's going to cost, and if we harvest all the energy of the people that would like this trail to happen. So I urge you to vote for the bill, and the day the last gap on the Oregon Coast Trail is closed, this trail is going to go into the top tier of world-class village-to-village hikes. We really ought to do it. Thank you.
Good morning. And thank you for this opportunity to tell you why I support House Bill 3149. My name is Walt Schroeder. I and my family have lived in Gold Beach on the South Coast for 45 years. My wife and I moved to Dallas Retirement Village at 310 West Ellendale in Dallas, Oregon, in 2012, when my wife became ill, in order to be closer to our sons and their families. I'm particularly pleased to be here today because from 1985 to 1993, I spent quite a bit of time in the chairs that you're sitting in right now. I served on the Agriculture, Forestry, and Natural Resources Committee, and you got a new name now. And for four terms as a member, vice chair for two terms, and chair for the final term before I voluntarily retired. The Oregon Coast Trail was an idea proposed by Dr. Sam Dickin, professor of geography at the University of Oregon. A plaque at the Natural Bridges parking area between Gold Beach and Brookings is dedicated to his memory and his thanks for working on the trail. I'll leave this with you after the program. In Oregon, we have many beautiful trails. The Pacific Coast Trail, which I've hiked quite a bit of, the High Desert Trail, and many others. The Oregon Coast Trail is totally different from the other trails in several respects. One, it passes through and around many towns, lending itself to a village-to-village hike and making it possible for hikers to stay overnight in motels and eating in restaurants, thereby contributing to the coastal economy. It is in many different segments. It allows for short hikes before returning to Highway 101. It opens up exceptionally beautiful segments of the ocean, not often seen even from Highway 101. It is relatively level through most of its length. It permits exploring tide pools and isolated beaches. It provides healthy outdoor recreation, and it provides opportunities for bird watchers and wildflower and plant enthusiasts to revel in their hobbies. I became interested in the Coast Trail shortly after moving to Curry County as Oregon State University Extension agent in 1967. Recognizing the need for a Coast Trail, I contacted the Harris Beach State Park Ranger and found out a Coast Trail was being considered by his district. So I started to build a section. I decided quickly it was more than a one-person job. So I wrote a news article inviting others to join me at a certain date and place. The interest was overwhelming and developed into a Friday and Saturday morning event in the spring and again in the fall for about 30 years. Volunteers numbering from 5 to 20 showed up to work every work party, and we built many miles of coast trail and thousands of hours. Some adopted segments of the trail to maintain between the scheduled work parties, and occasionally emergency work parties were set for special projects. For example, when a storm wiped out a portion of the trail, we'd have a special project meeting. Volunteers included men and women retirees, some still employed who could make it on a Saturday, 4-H club members, the Gold Beach High School Student Council, and others. It became so popular that when we were not working on the Coast Trail, we built many new trails and opened up and maintained several long-forgotten trails all over Curry County. Included for this committee is a document. Most of the trails in Curry County and neighboring county friends have worked on and are still working on for these past 40 years. Building and maintaining trails has several benefits. They give the builders a real sense of accomplishment in completing a project, knowing that our efforts will benefit many others, providing an opportunity to work with like-inspired folks who become good friends, accomplishing a worthwhile project, seeing beautiful scenery seldom seen by others, and it's good, healthy exercise. The Oregon Coast Trail is begging for completion. House Bill 3149 is a vital step in this process. Thank you for this bill and for the many hours you invest as legislators in making Oregon a better place. Thank you.
Any questions for this group?
Thank you very much.
That was really wonderful. And thank you, Representative, for making the trip over here. I'm sure it's not always easy, but Representative McEwen would like to say something.
Oh, thank you, Chair Clem. Representative Schroeder, I just want to tell you how delightful it is to have you here.
I've been born and raised in Coos Bay, and your reputation precedes you here, and certainly in House District Number 9 as well as House District Number 1. And as a girl who has a great heart for Curry County, I just want to thank you for taking the time to come up here and bring attention to this important issue. With great respect, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. Your name is very familiar.
I think so. We go way back.
I was also a 4-H agent in Coos County for 6 years.
Yes.
So I knew a lot of Coos County folks, too.
Well, thank you for your good work, sir, and thank you for your time.
Okay, let's get the Shemekinans up here. So Anthony, Bob, and Lucy.
I think that's Ann.
Or Ann, I'm sorry. Oh, I saw Anthony out of that.
I think that's me.
Okay. And after butchering your name, you get to go first. Okay, Bob, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. My name is Robert Bailey, Bob Bailey. I'm here representing the Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition. First of all, I want to say I'd like to echo the kudos to Representative Schroeder. I've hiked many sections of that trail down in Curry County, and it's just phenomenal the what one person can do to trigger the efforts that resulted in that fabulous trail. So Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition is very pleased to support this bill that we hope will hasten the completion of the Oregon Coast Trail. The Oregon Coast is, in our view, Oregon's signature geographic feature. We believe that a completed Oregon Coast Trail, one that is safe and well-maintained, would show off our coast in all her glory and add immeasurably to the Oregon Coast mystique. We also believe that it will make a significant economic contribution to the economies of the coastal communities as new generations of coastal visitors seek to experience the coast in very personal ways. The bill will elevate the status of the Oregon Coast Trail and put it squarely on the to-do list of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. The action plan called for in the bill will provide a strong reason for many outside interests to support completion of the trail. So the Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition urges that your approval of the bill. Thank you.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Lucy Hilburn. I live in West Salem, and I'm here to urge your support of House Bill 3149 from the perspective of legions of village-to-village walking enthusiasts here and abroad. In the fall, I walked the Camino to Santiago de Compostela in northern Spain, which is a village-to-village walk of about 500 miles. Over the course of 48 days, I was astonished to find that I was meeting and talking with fellow walkers from 46 countries who ranged in age from 20 to 80. More than 250,000 people walk that village-to-village walk each year. Some of the village-to-village walks in the world feature historic sites like the Camino in Spain or the 88 Temples Trail in Japan. Others feature geography, like England's Coast-to-Coast Trail, or the Queen Charlotte Sound or Milford Track in New Zealand. But none of them offer the spectacular combination of beaches, forests, and headlands over more than 300 miles that our coast has to offer. Our Oregon Coast Trail has the potential to attract visitors from out of state and from abroad who would patronize local businesses for lodging, food, and services without adding to vehicular traffic on Route 101. For ourselves, for our visitors, and for our coastal towns, let's take this step to finish the trail and make it the international showcase it deserves to be. Thank you.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, I'm Ann Hannes, and I'm here representing the Shemekinans. It's the oldest outdoor club in Salem. We have over 700 members that are hikers, climbers, cross-country skiers, and canoe kayakers. We strongly support House Bill 3149. Oregon's coast ranks high among our state's crown jewels. And one of the things to keep in mind is that Oregon is one of only three states in in the country that have its entire coast as public beaches. So we have a rare opportunity combined with the Oregon Beach Bill and the vision that was set forth with the passage of that historic act. I think we can honor the legacy of that beach bill on its 50th anniversary and complete the trail. The trail will not only benefit avid hikers like myself, but as you've heard, it will attract tourists from around the world. And this is different than the Pacific Coast Trail, where people load their backpack, they put in their food, they buy it, and then they're off on the trail for days on end. In this case, people are going to stop along the way, they'll stay at hotels, they'll eat in restaurants. It'll have a transformative effect on the coastal economies. And I say that not only as a representative of the Shemeckitans, but also as a former state economist, and knowing what this economic impact can be. And I think it will be an incredible opportunity to hike along the most gorgeous coastal scenery in the world. So in summary, I think you have a rare opportunity to enact legislation this session. I know it's been a tough session, but this is a really good bill that'll set forth a legacy for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this group?
Thank you.
Neutral. Al LePage, could you join us? And then David Stipe and Jerry Bohard. Al, could you start us off?
Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Al LePage. I'm the executive director of the National Coast Trail Association. Our primary goal and current focus is the completion of the Oregon Coast Trail. A little bit about myself. I like to sleep on the ground.
Okay.
This hat probably attests to that, because it hiked with me the 400 miles from the Columbia River to the California border back in 2008, as you will see in the piece of information that is now being passed out by the assistant up there. I hiked the trail back in 1988 when the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department declared the trail hikeable. So it was quite an odyssey for me back then as a young man, and then 20 years later to do it again in my capacity as a representative of the National Coast Trail Association. I think I can summarize my testimony today basically in three words, and that's plan, money, and fund. First, in terms of planning, when the Oregon Recreational Trails Advisory Council was formed in 1971, state parks hired their first state parks trails coordinator. And they made the Oregon Coast Trail the number one priority. Sam Dickin, who is the father of the Oregon Coast Trail, the man who envisioned the idea back in 1959 and advocated for it for 12 years, was hired as its first consultant to hammer out a plan for the Oregon Coast Trail in the early 1970s. Now, as an organization working on this, realizing the need for an updated report, our organization researched, crafted, and sent our recommendations in 2005 to OPRD in the form of a 100-page-plus document, Oregon Coast Trail Missing Links, Priorities, and Solutions. Now, in 2011, as has been referenced here today, the agency, based on our 2005 report, actually developed an Oregon Coast Trail connection strategy, and in a presentation to the Oregon State Parks Commission, stated their intent with a basic strategy to fill in the gaps with a proposed target date of 2021. So, fast forward about 10 years later, given the proposed completion date of 2021 and the need for extensive lead time to actually do this type of work, our organization field researched and crafted an extensively revised and updated a version of our former recommendations in 2005 for the agency in another 100-page-plus report, Oregon Coast Trail 2021, Final Connections Logistics Strategy. It was completed towards the end of 2015, and last spring, a year ago, I was presenting it to state park rangers, district managers, and also Dennis Comfort, the coastal manager for OPRD along the whole length of the Oregon coast. Therefore, in terms of the plan, given the agency's own connection strategy plus our final connections report based on extensive field research with recommendations to complete the gaps and to create a quality recreational trail experience, these existing documents could substantially inform both OPRD and ODOT in terms of developing the plan this bill would mandate. Plus, we could also offer additional assistance as a nonprofit organization in this regard. So that's the plan part. Two quick asides here. Number one, OPRD. All I will say is that the directive of this bill for the agency to develop a plan with the expected intent to implement it would formally elevate state parks' involvement in working towards the development, the completion of the Oregon Coast Trail. The other aside is ODOT. Essentially, in our 2015 report, our most recent report, we recognized the need and recommended that OPRD and ODOT develop an interagency agreement to streamline the process of developing missing gaps in the Oregon Coast Trail. These gaps would either be the only available option of a route to get people off the highway, say along the shoulder, but within the ODOT right-of-way, or in other situations, ODOT does own some land on the coast, and it would be offered as a preferred route that would lend itself to developing not only a vital linkage, but one that would create what I call the wow factor, which is a quality recreational trail experience. ODOT's participation, therefore, is vital for success in this regard. Money. The economic and quality of life benefits of trails has been pretty well documented in studies across the country, and combined with the State Comprehensive Outdoor Recreation Plan, which was just revised, and also the Oregon Tourism Commission research, when you combine all these studies, it shows that there's really economic benefit to trails. That's really out there. Because number one, they provide a sustainable resource for the economy. Number two, they help stabilize the economy with such a sustainable resource. And number three, overall, they enhance the local economy. So that's about all I'm going to say about money in that regard. Last part, funding. This bill also includes developing a fund dedicated to implement the eventual plan. And part of that funding could be potential appropriations from the legislature. And this is where I'm going to differ a bit from my colleagues today in support of the bill. All I would say is, without the resources to make a plan happen, it simply can't. Therefore, it's our recommendation that this bill, as an amendment to it, would also hopefully include an appropriation from the general fund for a specified amount. And not only for this biennium, but for every biennium in perpetuity. And having worked on this trail and seen other trails in the country for about 23 years, I think this is necessary. And let me tell you why. Because, number one, it provides the kind of dedicated and stable funding needed to, first of all, develop the plan. Number two, it provides OPRD and ODOT the monetary resources up front that could be required as a financial match in applying for grants, thereby enhancing their ability to potentially leverage even more funding. It's about investing in the trail and leveraging more money as well. And number three, such ongoing funding would proactively address what I call the wind, waves, and rain challenge of coastal trails, the erosional processes of the coast that knock down trees, cause landslides, and wash out the shoreline. And such funding is always needed to repair and maintain coastal trails, too. So in summary, I'm suggesting an appropriation with a specified amount for trail building and maintenance from the general fund for each biennium in perpetuity would provide the kind of funding needed to successfully develop and implement the plan, not only to build the trail, but also to maintain it in perpetuity. Therefore, we do support House Bill 3149, requiring the development of a plan for the Oregon Coast Trail. Of course, establishing the fund and continuously appropriating monies in this fund for state parks to develop and implement the plan. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. And also, I'd like to make myself personally available to any of the representatives on this committee. I will be more than willing to drive up from Eugene and speak with them in person in their office.
Okay. David, I've got you next.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, good morning. My name is David Stipe. I'm the manager of planning and design with Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. My testimony was entered into the record yesterday afternoon, and I won't be reading it in. I'll just be here to answer any questions that you might have based on my testimony.
Okay, Jerry.
Good morning, Chair Clem, committee members. For the record, my name is Jerry Bohard. I'm the Transportation Development Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And as you've heard, what's being proposed here is a joint action plan between us and State Parks and Recreation. We do recognize that there are gaps in the trail requiring folks to travel on the shoulders of US 101, and we do support a safe walking and biking facility for all users. And we can participate when the development of these facilities is on the state highway system. If you're not aware, US 101 is also a high priority bicycle touring route and an official scenic byway as designated by the USDOT. And we're also in the process of developing an Oregon Coast bicycle route plan. With regards to the action plan, and as I was reading the bill, it's really unclear the level of effort that will be required for components of the action plan. From the planning and engineering perspective, it appears really to require the development of specific projects for those options for the gaps within the trail. This would require some level of preliminary engineering and design work to really look at what those feasible options are. And ultimately, we would need resources in order to complete that work. And then just in closing, as a reminder, although I'm sure many of you are aware, that our highway funds cannot be used outside of the highway right-of-way. So I, too, will be glad to answer any questions.
Questions from this panel? Mr. Bretta.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Al, I appreciate your introducing an amendment that, well, your honesty in saying, look, you're going to need some funding for the general fund to make this thing work. So you had mentioned some studies, and a lot of studies have been done on the cost benefit of trails. Do you have any numbers as far as what you're thinking costs of the general fund and maybe for the initial, you know, finishing of the trail and then ongoing into perpetuity, as you mentioned, annually or biannually? And then the benefit, too. I mean, you know, what kind of dollars this generates along the coast for the different communities?
To answer your question about studies, as I said, there have been many studies done across the country on different trail systems. So each trail system is pretty unique. But the general gist of these studies shows that it does have economic benefits when you develop a trail. And like I said, I could make those studies available to people via email, links, things like that, or a visit to your office. In terms of the amount of money, if you reference that newsletter that's part of your packet, after me with the beard on the trail in there. That's actually me in 2000.
I thought that was Jedediah Smith.
Well, yes, so to speak.
I was wondering about that.
So if you look at that, there was a recreational grant that was applied for by state parks, is my understanding. And here's an example, by the way. This is an excellent example of leveraging funding and why some funding in the fund would be good. Because recreational trail program grants, you've got to put a 20% match up front. And that can be volunteer time, that can be staff time, but it can also be cash. And 80% of that comes from the federal. So there's a grant on the back on the Oregon Coast Trail for $162,000, okay? 80% of that came from federal funds. And 20%, I'm assuming, may have come from OPRD itself. So they put in about $30,000 and they got, you know, about the bulk of the rest of about another $130,000. So that's to repair about 7 miles of trail. Repair and restore about 7 miles of trail at $162,000, okay? Let's just say you had 7 miles of trail to do every year. That'd be $162,000 a year. I'm just using that as an example, okay, because it's pretty concrete, okay? So let's say it's a quarter of a million per biennium, say, to maintain trails. Okay, so it's $125,000 a year, let's say, something like that. That's a pretty good deal for a trail. And when you look at the studies and the economic generation of benefits, and by the way, the groups talked a lot about village-to-village, a type of, you know, touring on the coast. I'm a campsite to campsite hiker, okay? And so part of our plan that we have put together for state parks is also to have the kind of camping that's available along the whole length of the coast. And there's some gaps in the camping right now. So in terms of answering your question, you know, I think it would be nice to put like $250,000 in there. And, you know, I do live in the state. I live in Eugene. I tried to testify for Ways and Means Committee in Eugene, but I left because the line was out the door and I knew I'd never get to speak. So I know it's a tough budget in this state, but a bill like this, and I have never invoked the 50th anniversary of the beach bill before in my testimony, but, you know, given that it is, and given that state parks had originally in 2011 said 2021 to really complete the Oregon Coast Trail, I think it would be good to give it teeth if it wasn't done in perpetuity, which I think it should be in the legislation, at least in this session, and that might be real tough to do, to at least do $250,000 so that, you know, it would be a basic seed fund at least to get things going.
Thank you.
And as the ODOT referenced, and I think I heard you right, they're going to need resources to do their engineering work in terms of various gaps on the trail.
You got that.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McClain.
I think this is for ODOT, but I, you know, the amendment looks like what they're suggesting, and we heard at least three people speak to this as well, was that they were hoping to raise funds, you know, to help with the plan and actually make a, you know, a particular place to deposit those types of fundraising dollars. And I guess I want to know if you, looking at the bill, I mean, to me the timing seems all, you know, if you're going to have this done by the reporting time that's there, you'd have to start when?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McClain, the September of 2018, we really would have almost had to have started yesterday because we would probably use the consultants and have that individual under contract in order to do the work. So it is a very quick turnaround time. It is something that's possibly doable. That is also one of the reasons that it does increase the cost when you do something a little bit quicker. It just takes a little bit more money.
And I guess the second question I would have would be, is parks, right? You're with parks. And when you're talking about, you know, two agencies getting together to work on the plan, and we know they have some requirements for how their dollars are spent, what would you be looking at if it wasn't, you know, where would the money come from if it wasn't coming from donations and other resources?
If the money were to come from OPRD, we would just have to adjust our priorities in our park maintenance work, likely. And staffing priorities. If we would probably do the same thing that ODOT would do, if we're leading up the evaluation work and the preliminary engineering, we would have to hire a consultant, but we would also have to have staff dedicated to managing that consultant and convening local stakeholders mm-hmm. in a public process.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, two questions I've got. So for parks, is this kind of work, either building trails or repairing trails, something that is eligible within your Measure 76 funding? I think it's, it used to be Measure 66, I think, but now it's called 76, if I remember right.
We, Chair Clem, we have FIP money. We call it the Facility Enhanced Investment Program. We also have the Trail Services Program within OPRD's budget, and we also have a program called Design Services, and we work on trail projects throughout the state using our funding sources. Incidentally, we're working on a 3-ish mile section of the Oregon Coast Trail, the gap at Cape Foulweather. And we identified some outside funding through federal highways, and we've entered into a partnership with the county to have them do some of the construction work, in addition to having our crews do some of the construction work to try and manage the costs. And so we do spend our money on trails.
I know those are technical funds, but are they all coming out of the lottery that's the dedicated part? I'm just trying to figure out, are we talking about competing with schools for money, or is this the cordoned off part that can only be used for capital parks acquisition, and then the other part, I think, is maintenance of those things that have been acquired?
Chair Clem, I'm going to have to get back with you on that answer. I've been with the agency for about a year now, and I'm preparing my first budget as a planning manager. So
it's probably more ways and means discussion anyway, but I thought if you happen to be there. Okay, then for ODOT, you mentioned the prohibition on the use of the highway fund outside of the highway or the right-of-way. So those construction elements that you saw in some other states where they, in the right-of-way, made a path and built some kind of barrier, is that an allowable use because it's still in the right-of-way?
Chair Clem, yes, if it's in the right-of-way, we do have some options of what pedestrian facilities that we can provide. Not knowing where those pictures came from the other states, they may not have the same restrictions on the use of our funds.
But if it goes off into a trail, no. If it's right along the road, maybe.
And I think, as others talked about, sometimes we have right-of-way in different places. So one of the key things we would do in a project like this is survey exactly where our right-of-way is and understand what some of our options are.
Okay. Okay. Any further questions for this group? Representative McHugh?
I guess, Chair Clem, just to clarify, and Ms. Bohart, you're in the details more than most of us on the transportation issues. But there are other funds available at times for pedestrian investment, bike and pedestrian, which comes through Connect Oregon. So there are other little bitty pots of money, never enough, and highly competitive, that can be available at times. And whether those would be available through a state parks project or not, there's some issues around how those come up through the local area commissions on transportation, but another option.
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative McEwen, you're correct. Connect Oregon is specifically for projects that are outside of the right-of-way to complement. And then we do have some federal funds called TAP funds, Transportation Alternative Program. But again, one of the key things that we do on those is make sure that there's a plan in order for them to be eligible. And I think sort of the theme that many of you all hear is that everything is oversubscribed. The needs are great with regards to bicycle and pedestrian needs throughout the state. We actually have a bicycle and pedestrian plan that has identified our needs going out many years as well. So,
thank you.
Okay. I think that's it. Thanks very much. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3149. And don't have Rep. Evans here, so let me go back to my little list and open a public hearing on House Bill 3147. Ask Rep. Brock Smith to tell us about this one.
Thank you, Chair.
3147 is, as I mentioned last week, it's just a simple fix with regards to having members appointed to the Oregon Hatchery Research Center Board, to where they consult with other agencies and take into consideration the nomination and recommendations from the various folks. It's at the request of former Representative Krieger, who's very much involved with the Hatchery Research Center.
I represent McEwen.
Chair Clem, I just wanted to comment that I appreciate Representative Brocksmith bringing this bill on behalf of Representative Krieger. This codifies the way in which ODFNW very thoughtfully can make those decisions about appropriate and skilled people who can take those seats on the Hatchery Research Center, which for all of those who live on the coast, fisheries are incredibly important. And the people that sit in those seats should have the appropriate skill set and expertise to make sure that, you know, the research is directed in a way that benefits those of us who care about our natural fisheries and our hatchery fisheries and the economic impact that all of our fisheries have on the coast. Make sure things are done well, done right, and the money is spent well. So I think this is a really good bill that hopefully you'll all support.
Okay. Tom and Joe, can you come on up? Let's see Tom. Let's see Joe.
See Joe. Hmm. He's fishing.
That's okay. We've got lots of other bills to do. So if Joe's,
Tom will let us
Tom will handle both of them, I suspect.
Chair Clem, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf with the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, here representing our members in the state. And again, I won't say the numbers. Joe unfortunately got called to an appointment up, so he won't be here. So I'm testifying for both of us in that we both our groups support this bill and think that it's a good bill. And we've been involved, both Joe and I, in various efforts led by former Representative Wayne Krieger to improve the Hatcher Research Center. We did a bill that helped in a bill in 2013 that provided changed some of the makeups of the bill of the Hatcher Research Center and provided new stimulus for increasing and other bills, including one that would allow the Hatcher Research Center to keep research money. So we think this is a good bill. This allows the director to talk to the groups that are already involved. Currently, we have a Trout Unlimited member, Kyle Smith, that sits on this board and has for a few years. And we think that this bill will help with the direction and allow groups that are currently involved to have some sort of input. So we support this bill. We think it's a good bill, and we urge that it goes forward. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for Tom?
No, thank you.
Okay, why don't you stay put, because you're on my next group too. That's it for 3147 that I've got, at least. So let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3147. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3153. Rep. Brocksmith, can you tell us about this one? And then, Tom, I'll have you
out,
go.
Chair Clem.
Oh, wasn't paying attention. I'm sorry. Can you tell us anything about this one?
I think that the folks who, I mean, these are the folks who really can talk to.
Okay, so Steve, why don't I get Steve Byerle and Bill Hannah? I'll let you all tell us about this bill, and then Tom's going to comment on it. Then we're going to have ODFNW after this first panel.
I'll take them.
Not sure what exactly was going on over there. Okay, so Steve and Bill, how about you tell us what you know about this bill?
Chair Clem, committee. My name is Steve Byerlin. I'm from Curry County, and Walt Schroeder is an icon down there. He was the ever-ready bunny building trails, and you see him out there in his age and condition and whatnot, and it really made anybody who looked at him feel bad. Worked with ODFW on one board or another or in-stream projects since 1970, so that's 47 years. You know, spent 23 years on different task force for ODFW, including the fish screening task force that was on for 13 years, and was part of the Spring Salmon Conservation Plan committee for the Rogues. And this bill is, right now, The Rogue had a fishing counting station at Gold Ray Dam, and Gold Ray Dam, it was taken out in 2010. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was kind of a byproduct of taking out Savage Rapids Dam. Gold Ray was the number six fish killer identified as a fish passage in the state. It was very old, and but unfortunately, it did serve some good, you know, in the fact that it gave a very exact count of fish going up. They could even tell the hatchery the wild because there's a camera count, and they could see the fish as they went up. since it's been removed, it's an indicator for the entire coast, you know, and they use that as to build their data for other streams and other fish runs, you know, because it had the empirical data for, 70 years, you know. Now that camera's gone, they can't see what it is, so they go in and do carcass counts after spawning to see how many wild fish have spawned and escaped, you know. And they can't do the whole area, so they just do samples here and samples there. They no longer tell spring fish from a fall fish as they come up. It used to be that there was a date that after July 15th, everything that came across the dam was a fall Chinook rather than a spring Chinook. Now they can't, you know, do that because they just get a spawning bed count. So, and in doing that, they also, on their spawning bed counts, have eliminated about 3 weeks of spawner counts because they're afraid one spawns with the other, and so they can't get a clear thing on it. Now, if we had a fish counting station back on the Rogue, you know, or a sonar, then we'd be able to separate spring fish from fall fish by the date that they came up. You know, and spring fish primarily ride the cold waters of the snow melt, you know, up the river, you know, and cross where the old counting station was. Fall fish wait until after the water starts to cool to come up. So there's a space there, and one side spring, one side fall, you know, and we have not been able to fish for a wild spring Chinook on the Rogue before the 1st of June for 7 years, you know, and it's all going by an estimate of how many spawners are counted. We need to have more than one system. You know, we need to know what the spawning bed counts are and do those counts, which are hard to do on the road because you're doing it from a drift boat. It's not like you're walking down the stream. There's some very limited spots where the fish counters, which are seasonal, people can walk down the stream, pick up a carcass, take measurements, chop it in half so they don't count it again. They do one side of the river one day a week, another side of the river another day of the week. But a lot of it has to be done from a drift boat, and where they reach down with a hook, grab the carcasses, throw them in the boat, and then pull over and count them. But if there's five carcasses laying there, you get one pass at it, and the guy running the boat has to be able to hold it, you know, while he's doing that. And B, as the guy leans over with the hook, it's off balance, you know, it'd be a very difficult rowing situation. And using seasonals that aren't experienced, their ability to hold the boat or, you know, retain the carcasses. It's a little bit dicey on, you know, using it as an indicator for all of our streams on the coast as to what's coming back. You know. And the fish counting sonar has been used all over the country, and it's gotten better and better. It's just a phenomenal piece of equipment that moves us ahead. And I want to save time for Bill, who from Sound Matrix, who is the expert on it, you know, to be sure you get a good overview on that, and then he comes, you know. I'd be any questions. I submitted my testimony, so it's better than what I can speak. I'm not a good speaker. So.
Okay, why don't you, Phil, tell us about the bill and your product.
All right. Could I close the... Chair Clem, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the time here today to talk to you. I'm Dan from Seattle. My company is Sound Metrics Corporation. We've been in business about 15 years. Prior to that, I was at the University of Washington Applied Physics Laboratory for 23 years, working on different sonar systems since the mid-1980s. So our company was spun out of the university, and I'd like to talk to you about the current state of the art. So back in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, fisheries acoustics were based on a counter made by Bendix Corporation. It put out a ping in the water, and you would see an oscilloscope trace like you see in yellow there on the left. And it was rather difficult to tell if that was a fish or a piece of driftwood coming down. There was no way to tell the direction of the target in the river, but that was the extent of technology available at the time. Oops. I can come back for a second. I think my timing is automatic there. In the center, the red tracks were from split beam technology. That would give you a track of a fish, but not an image of a fish. And split beam does allow you to determine the direction of travel, but it doesn't give positive identification of the fish. It's difficult to aim in certain circumstances. It's been supplanted over the last 15 years by our Didson and now Aeris technologies. These are both dual frequency sonars. Dual frequency means you can get better resolution at shorter ranges and better counting at longer ranges with one piece of equipment. And on the right side, you can see that the image of a fish actually looks like a fish. And so, you know, there's a very clear positive identification when you have fish coming through. Okay, so on the left here, this image was taken in the New Orleans Aquarium, and I'm using it so you can see just kind of what kind of detail you can see with sonar in the water on fish. These are tarpon and some other species. They're fairly large, so you can see different fin structures, see the swimming behavior and so on. Sorry, it keeps going back. And on the right side, that's a hand-cast net being pulled through a river, and then the fish there you see are about 4 inches long. So on the left we have fish that are about 3 feet long, on the right 4 inches long. So we can image adult fish, juvenile fish, even shrimp and smaller animals than that in the water.
So Rep Springer and I are going to need one of those on our boats by about noon, and what they like to eat, bite.
Yes. So this is our original product called the Didson for dual frequency identification sonar. It comes in two different models. The standard Didson would image out to about 35 meters, the long range out to about 80 meters. And once again, the image on the right came out of the University of Washington hatchery pond. Up close and personal, you can see fin structure. You could actually do species identification. At longer ranges, species identification is much more problematic, so I won't try and oversell that. In Alaska, which I'll get to in a moment, they do that through a combination of techniques. So this has all been passed out. I won't go read bullet point by bullet point, but the point of this slide is to say that we're continually working to improve our technology. Come back. And our current product line, Aeris, has a number of improvements over the Didson product line. So now we have an image here of Aeris with our X2 rotator that allows aiming and pan and tilt, or you can also set it up for tilt and roll. We now also have an AR3, we call it three-axis rotator, which allows you to point in any direction. For fisheries, that's not so important. Usually you're kind of pointed across a river watching the fish as they swim by. So this technology is used worldwide, and the applications in fisheries, as it says here, most of our customers use it for either enumeration of commercial or endangered fish runs. It's also used quite a bit for evaluating structural improvements around dams to fish ladders and bypass structures, that type of thing. It's used for habitat studies, looking at fish behavior. And given that fisheries management is usually a seasonal kind of program, out of season, when it's not in the water, it's available. You can use the same technology to do bridge and dam inspection, monitor erosion along riverbanks. It's used by law enforcement and fire departments for locating drowning victims, unfortunately, when that happens. Many different uses. Any time you'd like to see in low or zero visibility water, it gives you the ability to do that.
Just one sec. Rep. McKeon has got a question.
Chair Clem, just very quickly, gentlemen, I'm used to the Huntley Park scene reports that I get pinged on my phone, and I watch coho, steelhead, half-pounders. Why is this better than what they're doing at Huntley Park with the seine? What are we going to gain from this? And how much is it going to cost?
I'm sorry I can't address the seine program because I don't have any information on that. So
thank you.
I can address that a little bit, being from a 30-year fishing guide at Gold Beach. You know, mm-hmm.
I've been fishing out of a wood boat at Agnes for about 60 years.
I've just built one, and I'm
good
working
for you.
On the second one now, wood boat. The seining occurs at Huntley Park, which is about 8 miles up the Rogue. They use a 300-foot beach seine. They do 15 pulls a day, and when they do those pulls, they do it 3 days a week during the summer months, you know. So it probably wouldn't start until the water drops in July, you know, and then it goes on through until the water starts to come back up, you know. The sonar would be able to be used basically all through each run. You know, spring runs aren't looked at all. Ideally, in my view, there would be a sonar in the lower river and one in the upper river, you know, and they can compare as to where the fish went and be able to get a lot more data that way, you know.
And I think it's helpful for the committee to understand what we're using right now, mm-hmm. and where we may be going.
They've been doing the beach seine for over 50 years, and,
right.
so, and then they just, what gives it some accuracy is they compare year over year.
It's consistent.
And then depending on how high the water is, they have a formula, you know, where they would say that at this water level, 2.7% of the fish that we, you multiply it out, that we caught 2.7%, and then that gives them an idea how many fish went by, and it's just,
but you
it's
see
an
a benefit
indicator.
In the technology improving is what I'm trying to get
far.
At. So a net is not necessarily the most accurate way to predict the runs as this would be.
It's just an indicator, the netting is, you know, and it never was meant to be an exact count or anywhere close.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, Rep. Brocksmith.
It wouldn't, Steve, wouldn't this also be less stress on the fish?
By far, usually the when we're doing the seining, the water temperature is exceeding 70 degrees, you know, and on up to 75 degrees, and the fish are caught in the net, drug in, measured, you know, and then released, and there is a lot of stress on the fish. You know.
Okay, please.
All right, so the. Slide here shows that currently we have over 300 of these sonars deployed in various fish research and counting projects around the world. The largest state currently using them is California. We have 44 systems in place there. Our oldest customer, fisheries-wise, is Alaska. They started using the technology in 2002. And then we have Canada, the United Kingdom, Native American tribes have fairly large numbers. The slide didn't show up quite the way I designed it, but we have systems in China, Brazil, New Zealand, Australia, Russia, Japan, France, the UK, that's up there, all over the world. So this is a slide from of the California fish restoration projects, and just kind of gives you a little bit of an idea of the extent to which they're using our systems throughout the state. And this comes from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game website, just showing the extent of the rivers. There are 15 different rivers, I believe it is. There are 13 rivers with 15 counting stations. And an example of one of their most sophisticated deployments here on the Kenai River, you can see at river mile 13.7 on the right there, they use five different sonars. They have a problem. The early fish come in when the river is low, so they put two sonars in the river, one on each bank, to count as they're coming up. As the melt-off continues, the river levels rise, and they have to put other sonars in behind the first pair that they put in. Plus that island in the middle, the back channel, the water level rises enough where fish pass behind the island. So that's the fifth one. And you can see the picture of the tent, and they have five computers there, each one running one sonar. They have a 4G cellular connection back to their office, and so they can monitor all of these computers and all of the sonars remotely, so they don't have to have on-site staffing. Benefits you asked about before, there's really zero impact of counting and observing fish with sound. You can identify fish as positive targets as opposed to debris, carcasses coming downstream, that type of thing. And we have software. We do not do totally automated counting, but we have software that greatly improves the efficiency of counting and making reports and so on the fish. And then a little story here in the Sacramento River. They had a debate going on for about 40 years whether or not their program of trucking juvenile fish in tanks around all of the canals and irrigation projects and things and releasing them through these pipes, whether or not that was a really effective way of preserving the juvenile stock from predation. And what they found was the striped bass in the lower part of the river there were tuned to listen to them opening the hatches on these pipes that they would flush the fish down through. They would hear them and just line up right at the bottom of the pipe and have significant predation as they were releasing the fish. And we used to have this little clip on our website, but the California Department of Water Resources asked us to remove it because it was a little embarrassing for them that they were spending all this money feeding bass. So thank you very much for your time. I'm available for questions from anyone.
Rep. Brocksmith.
Thank you. So in essence, and Steve, you can chime in as well, this counting would be, of course, more accurate. It's computer-generated. Because right now they're just pulling in the fish and giving an estimate based on water levels and so forth. It would be, of course, extremely less stress to the fish. And as we move forward, as you mentioned before, people are sitting back in their office going over this data on their computers. So there's less labor and, of course, the costs associated with labor involved. And how did you say they, how many times, three times a week at Huntley Park is when they, yeah. And so the cost savings alone over time could assist in paying for the increased cost of the devices. I'm asking.
Chair Clem, Representative Smith, there is would be a cost savings, but I think the security that it brings to me, or the thought, is that we then have definitive information, you know. And so whether it's endangered species petition questions, or it's sportsmen that are upset with management, you know, and how things are going, One of the things I see in this technology is it can be adjusted for size, you know. And to me, I'm concerned not just by how many fish go up the river, but how many fish spawn successfully, you know. And you could have a lot of fish go up the river and have very poor successful spawning. And if we could set the equipment, I understand talking to Bill that you need a narrower spot, you know, but if we could set the equipment to be able to see a 7 or 8 inch Chinook salmon smolt, you know, which he says they can do, then get an idea on their migration timing clearly, and how many much the habitat is improving. No matter how much money we throw at things, you know, removing dams or doing other projects within the river, unless you've got that habitat producing when those fish spawn, you've got a problem. And then we can narrow down where we're focusing the fisheries. Also, on the Rogue, when it gets warm, has a propensity for common heiress outbreaks for disease. You know, if you had a counting sonar at the bottom end of the river at Huntley Park and one farther up the river, you would know what your losses were, you know, and be able to adjust river flows and stuff.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Thank you. And what are the costs associated with one of the RS units?
The sonar itself lists for $79,900, and that comes with all the included software, the post-processing software. The end user supplies any Windows 7 or higher PC, laptop, desktop, anything to record the files and process on. And our technical support is free for life.
And so I just want to add, Chair Klim, that the baseline data, as Steve mentioned, or data in general, is so critical when it comes to our fisheries, especially our river fisheries. And when you had testimony last week on the Rogue Sediment Study, I can see this this type of technology definitely benefiting the fisheries in the future.
Okay, so I'd like to get Tom's testimony, and then we're going to have ODF&W come up.
Chair Klim, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, representing Trout Unlimited. We support House Bill 3153. We currently, in some of the work that Trout Unlimited is doing on our wild steelhead initiative on rivers such as the Smith in California and the Ho in Washington, we've used some of the sonar technology, and it is remarkable, and it does work really well. So we think that this is a good thing. The only hesitation we have on this and concern is the cost, and we don't want to back ODFW into a corner by requiring them to use this and that not being able to fund this. So our concern is, how do we fund this? Because even though in the long run it could be cheaper, the initial outlay is rather expensive. So we just want to make sure there's adequate funding for this, and that if this bill goes forward, that we work with ODFW to make sure that we're not backing them to a corner as they go through their budget cycle and look at ways to fund this. So we do support it, but we want to make sure that the funding part is, the questions on that are answered. So that's my testimony.
Okay, great. I am going to ask ODF&W, and we'll talk about that right now. I'm sure they'll have a nice fiscal for us. So thank you, gentlemen, for coming up.
Thank you.
Hand down.
Good morning, Chair Klim, members of the committee. For the record, Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director, Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thank you for the discussion on House Bill 3153 today. I brought with me Sean. He is a research scientist out of our fish inventory evaluation program. And so I'm just going to turn over to him and let him talk about the sonar use in Oregon and some other technologies that we've looked into.
Thanks, Shannon. Chair Klim, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to testify here today. My name is Sean Clements. I'm a senior policy analyst with ODFW. As you've heard, DIDSON technology is not new. It's been in use for over a decade now. ODFW has evaluated whether to use it on the Oregon coast and in the Hood River on paper, and concluded that it wasn't the technology to go forward at that time. Beginning this year, we are going to try a field evaluation in the John Day River system in eastern Oregon, and we're hopeful that works out. The reasons ODFW hasn't embraced this technology more fully is because of the limitations it has. And so I just want to run through some of those so you have a full picture of where we are with it. First, it's unable to distinguish between species of a similar size, assuming their swimming behavior is similar. So it can't tell a coho from a chinook or a steelhead from a coho if they're of a similar size. And in a lot of our systems, we have considerable overlap in the run timing of these species. So we would have to do some subsampling of the fish at the time we're doing the measurements with the Ditson sonar devices. So that means getting in the river and pulling the fish out and seeing what species they are. Similarly, it's unable to distinguish between race, which is spring chinook versus a fall chinook, or a winter steelhead versus a summer steelhead. So, for example, in the Rogue, we have some considerable overlap of spring and fall chinook run timing. We would, again, have to do some subsampling to figure out whether it was a spring or a fall chinook. So that involves getting in the river and netting again. It's unable to distinguish between hatchery and wild, and we have a lot of hatchery issues on our rivers where we need to know the proportion of hatchery spawners in the river. So again, we'd have to do some subsampling. And then last, it can't tell the age of a fish unless you have very discrete length bins. So we would again have to do some subsampling to get scales to figure out what the age of the fish is. And we use the age information a lot in our run forecasting, particularly for chinook. So we really need to know how old these fish are when they're coming back. So subsampling, people typically do that by getting in the river and doing some netting, usually tangle netting. And we capture those fish, enumerate them, figure out what species they are, what age they are, and their race. And tangle netting on the Oregon coast is extremely controversial. People do not like us doing it. And it's also stressful to the fish. And as you heard earlier, the river temperatures in the Rogue and Umpqua are fairly hot. We'd be concerned about incidental mortality on those fish associated with the subsampling. So that's the resolution issues. The other issue is the cost. You heard the previous speaker talk about the cost of the device itself. In addition to that, you've got the site engineering that's required to put the device in place. You need the maintenance of the site. And you need people on hand to pull it out if there's a risk of flooding or anything like that. We also have concerns on the Oregon coast and a lot of places with vandalism, so we need to secure the site. Other costs involved, in addition to the device and the site engineering, are the costs associated with the subsampling, which is not insignificant. You're talking about personnel there to ever so often go into the river in a boat, capture fish, enumerate them, and do all that kind of work. There's a calibration period when you first put this technology into place to make sure you understand what it's telling you. So that can be anywhere from 2 to 5 years, depending on the target species in the system. So that's a upfront cost can be fairly significant, on the order of hundreds of thousands of dollars, we estimate. Ongoing costs following that are probably more on the order of, I'd say, $50,000 to $150,000, depending on the system and the target species. And you may still need to maintain the existing monitoring that we do because of the commitments we've made and a lot of our conservation recovery plans. For example, in the Rogue, we're focused on the early run spring chinook, and we need to know when they're spawning and how many of them there are. So this technology wouldn't tell us that. I just want to share with you where ODFW is thinking of going with technology. We're obviously interested and committed to improving our monitoring research in a fiscally responsible manner. And we have a group in Corvallis that's dedicated to doing this. Their current focus is in three areas. I'll just share two of those with you. The first is genetics, and I think you guys might be aware that ODFW and OSU are currently hiring a statewide geneticist, should be coming on board soon. That person's really going to lead a lot of our next-generation monitoring techniques. We think genetics is a very powerful tool with a lot of potential. We're actively exploring environmental DNA, which is where you can take a water sample and tell the range of species and potentially some idea of the biomass of species that are in that water. We're working with OSU and the Forest Service on that technology. There are also tissue-based technologies where you take a fin clip of the fish, and you can tell, if you sample in a certain way, you can tell how many adults produced the number of offspring that you've got. So we get at the productivity question that way, as well as the number of breeders. So we're working again with other folks to develop those technologies. Next, the habitat was brought up, and we recognize the difficulties of sampling habitat across such a vast state. We're working on using satellite-based and drone-based remote sensing technologies to fill in the gaps that we have. We're making substantial progress on that, and we're lucky at OSU to have some of the best remote sensors in the world there. So we are definitely interested in technology. We just recognize that there is no silver bullet for monitoring fish. There's a quote I've heard a few times that monitoring fish isn't rocket science, it's actually harder. And I believe that. The fish don't behave in ways we expect them to, and the environments we work in are challenging. So there is no silver bullet. It's going to take a range of methods to get at our questions, and we always have to keep our management issues in mind when we're talking about the technology to meet those information needs. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and be happy to take any questions.
Okay. He's doing all your talking, Shannon.
All our talking.
Yeah. Any questions for DFNW right now? Okay. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3153, open the public hearing on House Bill 3193, and ask Robert Bailey, James Jungworth, and Carrie, to join us, please. This is Representative Rocksmith, do you want to tell us about this or let our panel here? Okay, tell us what we need to know.
Okay, well, good morning, Chair Clem, committee members. My name is James Jungworth. My wife's name here is Kari Ryan. We are the seaweed harvesters that requested HB 3193. Carl Wilson's our state representative. We live in Josephine County. And Kari and I began harvesting edible and medicinal seaweeds from the southern Oregon coast in 1990. We sell these seaweeds through our mail order business, Nature Spirit Herbs, as dried sea vegetables, as well as a variety of like powdered and encapsulated products. Seaweeds provide about 75% of our family's income, and they provide a lot of much-needed employment in our rural community. Over the last 20 years or so, Cotty and I have been working with Oregon's resource management agencies, marine biologists, Oregon Sea Grant legislators, and so on, in an effort to gain visibility and to demonstrate the sustainability of our harvest. But I guess we didn't do a very good job because the Oregon State Legislature unintentionally shut down our thriving seaweed business in Oregon, or at least the harvest in Oregon, with the passage of Senate Bill 600 in 2011. Now we need to go to California to harvest all of our seaweeds for our business. There's currently nowhere for us to go to apply for a seaweed harvest permit in Oregon. Conflicting legislation regarding OPRD and DSL's territorial jurisdictions prevents either of these agencies from being able to issue a viable permit. This issue is described in detail in our written testimony. Also, OPRD simply does not have the mandate to allow commercial harvest of anything. So, House Bill 3193 fixes this problem of conflicting territorial jurisdictions the issue with OPRD's mandate by assigning jurisdiction over seaweeds to ODFNW. ODFNW governs by the organism, not by the territory. So HB 3193 would make the regulation of seaweed harvesting comparable to the regulation of clam or mussel harvesting in Oregon. This is not a novel approach. In fact, Oregon is the only West Coast state in which the Department of Fish and Wildlife is not responsible for the management of the harvest of seaweeds. California, Alaska, British Columbia have all had effective small-scale commercial hand harvesting permit systems in place for decades, and we could learn much from their experience as well. We're requesting your support for House Bill 3193. This bill gives our family business a chance to grow and thrive, and it also gives Oregon the opportunity to develop a permit system for small-scale commercial hand harvesting of seaweeds, a unique and ecologically sustainable cottage industry. Passage of House Bill 3193 would be a win-win situation. A sustainable new cottage industry that does not compete with any other American industry. There is a steadily increasing demand for high-quality domestic seaweeds as gourmet foods and as therapeutic dietary supplements. The United States currently imports almost all of our seaweeds from Asia, where pollution is also often a concern. In Northern California, where I have a permit now as well, the total harvest of edible seaweeds is somewhere between 20 and 30 tons per year, and I'm estimating that the value of the products produced from this harvest is somewhere in the vicinity of $500,000. So it's not a huge industry. Production of high-quality edible and medicinal seaweed products is very labor-intensive, and it provides a high level of employment and a high level of value in relation to the small amount of seaweed resources harvested. We harvest ourselves about 4 to 6 tons of seaweed per year for our business, and this provides enough income to support our family and a lot of seasonal hired help from our community. Seaweeds are also broadly beneficial to people's health. For example, the Japanese people's remarkable longevity and extremely low incidence of thyroid disease, breast cancer, and prostate cancer may well be due to the fact that they have the world's highest per capita seaweed consumption. Therefore, passage of House Bill 3193 would be beneficial to our family business, to coastal economies, to restaurants, to the local food movement, and to people's health. I encourage you all to read our written testimony as well. Included in our written testimony is a copy of a letter that we wrote to Kurt Melcher, the director of ODF&W in 2015. The letter explains the legal background and history of our seaweed harvest, our efforts to work with the state of Oregon, and it asks what would need to be done in order for ODF&W to be able to manage Oregon's seaweeds. Also included is a copy of Kurt Melcher's informative reply to our letter. His letter was the basis for the construction of House Bill 3193. Additionally, there's a copy of House Bill 3193 with a few suggested edits. Nothing of consequence. It's a very well-written bill, in my opinion. We've also submitted a description of our seaweed harvest methods, a copy of the Oregon Institute of Marine Biology research study that demonstrates the sustainability of our harvest methods, conducted by Linda Shapiro some years ago. We've included a copy of our Nature Spirit Herbs catalog so you can understand a little bit better what we do and about our products. And then last but not least, there's a copy of Seaweeds and Human Health, a paper that I wrote about the health benefits of eating seaweeds. In conclusion, I'd just like to say that seaweeds are a very valuable resource and that the state of Oregon has a real opportunity here. I hope that we will use that opportunity wisely. Thank you for your time and attention. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. And, Carrie, did you wish to testify? Your moral support here? Okay. Bob?
Thank you, Chair Clem. Again, for the record, my name is Robert Bailey. I'm speaking today. Actually, I'm going to speak up with two hats on. The first one is as a board member for Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition, then I'll follow up in a moment with some personal remarks. Oregon Shores is pleased to support House Bill 3193. Now, this support may come as a surprise to some of the members of the committee, but we believe that this is a well-thought-out bill that will modernize Oregon's ability to manage its rocky intertidal areas to allow reasonable human use of these resources while ensuring that ecosystem values are protected. We also believe that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, with its increasing expertise in its marine habitat program, is the appropriate agency to regulate harvest of all seaweeds along the Oregon shore, and it has the scientific capacity to develop and administer regulations envisioned by the bill. We commend the bill's sponsors for acknowledging the responsibilities, though, of all three agencies with that who have overlapping duties along the ocean shore, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, which, as you know, as the Ocean Shore Management Authority along the beaches, and the Oregon Parks, Oregon Department of State Lands, which has jurisdiction over the publicly owned state tidelands. We agree that provisions providing for the memorandum of agreement among the agencies, because we believe that it will be essential to ensuring that the management of seaweed harvest is fully integrated into the management responsibilities of the other two agencies. We are pleased, especially, that the bill eliminates the antiquated kelp leasing authority of the Department of State Lands, which, frankly, has not been used for years, but has still been on the books. We believe that the bill fills this longstanding regulatory gap in rocky intertidal areas where seaweeds are, in fact, being harvested even now without oversight. The bill sets standards that we believe are sufficiently prescriptive to result in sensible regulations to ensure environmentally sensitive management of the harvest of seaweeds. We look forward to working with the Department of Fish and Wildlife and other partners in the rulemaking process, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Oregon Shores. I'd like to just take a quick moment to say
really quick
that for almost 25 years, I ran the Oregon Ocean Management Program through the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I met the young worst at that time as they came to the state looking for a permit to regulate their harvest. They were not interested in going off on their own, but came seeking a legitimate, responsible harvest. And I worked closely with them and with state parks, Fish and Wildlife, to try to find a way for them to do this. I went out on site with them a number of times to see what they do and how they do it. And we were unable at that time, as James said, to get the job done. So I was thrilled to see this bill come forward, and I'm really pleased with what it does in general to, I think, modernize and streamline a big gap in Oregon's total ability to manage its rocky intertidal areas, including the harvest of seaweeds. So from a personal point of view, I'm very pleased with this and encourage you to support the bill.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill
3193
and open a public hearing on House Bill 2866. Thank you for coming up. Ask Representative Evans to join us. And Shannon, do you want to join Representative Evans just to save time? Okay. Tell us about this one. Welcome.
Do you read the bill or just
no.
Okay?
We have you tell us.
All right, sounds good. Chair Clem, members of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources, thank you very much for getting me up today. I am Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, covering the communities of Monmouth, Independence, West, and parts of South Salem. And for Representative Escoval, I am, in fact, from time to time called the representative from the task force district. But today I'm not here about a task force. I'm here about two problems that have been long known. Problems that are likely to have no comprehensive solution, but problems that require at least some remedy nonetheless. Before I continue, before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and my most recent activities with emergency preparedness, et cetera, salmon policy and natural resource policy was my academic training. So this is a particular interest, though I do not sit on this committee. House Bill 2866 would increase the net return of salmon carcasses to 50% of harvest levels. It would also purposefully set aside eggs from these carcasses for small businesses that over the past decade, at least in our district, lost significant access rights to eggs from Oregon salmon. Let me begin with a little bit of a background, some of which you probably know. I chose salmon policy a long time ago because it touches so many areas of our geography, so much of our natural state. One of the hardest things for us to remember is that the industrial economy and the natural economy are different. The industrial economy teaches us how to navigate a complex world. We're called upon to value labor in terms of dollars and cents, where optimization of profit is understandable. In fact, it's desirable. The industrial economy teaches us that waste is all of the potential profits left on the table, or in this case, left in the rivers or on the shores. And yet there is actually no such thing as waste in the natural economy. For 12 million years, salmon colonized the Pacific Northwest. Let me explain that again. Salmon colonized the vast reaches of the Columbia River system. Many people look at our natural wonder and think, wow, isn't it amazing? Look at the salmon. The life cycle is proof of the complexities of our biological diversity in the ecosystem of the Northwest. And to some degree, this wonder is justified. However, salmon to a large degree, salmon colonization is the foundation upon which the farthest reaches of our Columbia River Basin was actually built. The life cycle of the salmon is nothing less than an organic solar transference machine. Over the 3 to 5 year lifespan of salmon, they migrate to the ocean, draw in energy from organisms powered by the relationship between the sun and the microorganisms dependent upon the sun, and then return energy in the form of fat stored in the bodies of salmon to their origin, or nearby. The massive sharing of energy and nutrients is what built our ecosystems over time, and that is why I'm here. Once upon a time, we changed our relationship with the salmon from partner to feudal lord and master, where we humans determine what species shall continue, how they will continue, where they will continue, and in the numbers they shall continue. And in our efforts to optimize maximum sustainable profits, also known sometimes as annual sustainable yield, maximum sustainable yield, I'm sure there's new words that have come along the way, and a host of other industrial metaphors, we forget that waste is a foreign concept to living organisms. In the past, millions of carcasses would pile up on the shores and fill the rivers. Probably not a very smelly or nice smell, but nonetheless it was important. These carcasses would feed the flora and fauna of the ecosystem and spark the biodiversity of our region. My concern is we've taken too much for too long and forgotten that we can maintain at least a portion of natural health by returning the carcasses to riparian areas from which they came, or at least to some place nearby. The department does that now. I'm asking for an increase. The bill seeks to force a conversation. And again, I understand when cash-strapped agencies are unable to do as many of the things as they perhaps would like to do, and that there are complexities of policy, complexities of economic and international dynamics. However, and it may seem counterintuitive, if we place more carcasses back into the natural systems, we will realize better, stronger, more sustainable harvests of salmon as well as other species. The second part of the bill is the removal of eggs, or some of them, prior to replacement in the riparian areas for our local guides and sportsmen and sportswomen. In my district, not less than three guides, once known internationally for the quality of their eggs, cannot compete any longer because of policy shifts over the past 7 years. I believe it is time we rethink the strategy and reinvigorate both our natural world as well as our local small businesses. I'm certain the agency will have a slightly different perspective, and I respect that. If I was in their place, I would likely be concerned with such a dramatic shift in policy as well. However, I'm not in their place. I was elected to bring forward legislation, at least in part, to begin the hard conversations we must have. It is to that end I ask for your consideration and deliberation on this matter. I think we need to find a way to increase more carcasses out in the riparian areas to help provide that energy transference and help the flora and fauna, because I think our natural world is undergoing a lot of change and they need as much help as possible.
Okay. Questions for Representative Evans? I don't know if you can. Are you able to stay the last few minutes to?
I will stay chair as long as you allow me to.
They'll kick us out here in 4 minutes. Rep. McKeown.
Quick question, mm-hmm. Chair Clem.
Chair Evans, I'm trying to find it, but I don't remember which session it was. We passed a bill that actually allows for carcasses to be placed back on shore. We had some issues with how the ORSs were written, and I don't remember which session it is. Representative Esquivel may remember. This came through our committee. Representative Witt may remember. And this differs from that, and I'm trying to figure out in what regard.
It expands the number and the percentage.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this just makes it bigger.
More okay. Fish, more carcasses out.
Okay, all right. Thank you for the clarification. I can't recall what the other one was, and I haven't been able to find it, so thank you.
Okay, let's hear from Shannon, then we can come back. Please.
All right. Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director, Department of Fish and Wildlife, for the record. This is a good conversation to have. I very much appreciate it. The testimony that you'll see right now just runs us through the numbers of what we're doing with carcasses currently. So we have 42.6% going back into stream enrichment. 27% were sold. 18.3% were provided to the food bank. 11.5% we collect for brood stock so we can produce more fish. And then there's a small percentage that goes to use for educational. So that's for 2013 to 2015. If we need to look at those percentages and the use of those fish and change it, I'm very much willing to have that conversation. There is a memorandum of agreement with DEQ. There's certain locations we cannot use for stream enrichment, so we have to keep that in mind because they're 303 listed for temperature or sediment or something else, that more enrichment is not needed in that case. As to the selling of carcasses and eggs, this is a bid process, and of course we want folks to come and take the whole fish and the whole return. We are not able, it's not really effective that people come pick and choose or just take the eggs or just take the fish. So fortunately in the last decade or so through this bid process, we've had some pretty big large businesses able to accommodate that request, but it has to a degree left out these little small businesses who would just like the eggs or a small percent or the pickings of what comes in and is chrome bright. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Okay, questions for this group? Representative Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have seen signs on the Rogue River in the upper that wouldn't allow you to even throw a carcass back in. Mm-hmm. In fact, I saw one in the Holy Water, which really astounded me, since the Holy Water is a catch and release. Mm-hmm. But they did post the whole river. And I think what I'm getting to is that it seems like we have special interest groups that are dictating what we're doing with our wildlife and our fisheries. And that's the wrong approach. We need to make sure that what we're doing is correct. Because if my memory serves me correct, didn't we have a ban at one time of putting a carcass back in the river? Which made no sense whatsoever, because I know those fish didn't get out of the water, go up 100 yards from the stream, and die.
Chair Clem, Representative Escobar, we did have that. We just recently changed it, so it does make a little bit more sense. We still don't want them accumulating around boat ramps, but certainly the angler out in the middle of nowhere can return his carcass.
Follow?
Yeah.
It was just what it was is the special interest groups of the rafters not wanting to see that. And we can't kowtow to special interest groups. We have to do what's best for the wildlife.
Representative Evans. Yeah.
Chair Clem, Representative Escobar, I agree with you wholeheartedly. The issue in some cases, at least I'm told, is also disease. They want to make sure that they don't put diseased fish out there, which makes every sense in the world. That said, for 12 million years, the fish went where they wanted to go. And
the
it actually made our riparian areas rich with nutrients, and I hope we can get back to that point.
Okay, thanks. I'm close the public hearing on House Bill 2866. I'm going to carry over the public hearing on House Bill 3016 and talk about that next time because we're out of time. And also, I want to carry over the work session on House Bill 2095, and I need to chat with Metro for a second about a question I've got about this bill that I should have thought of a lot earlier and not had you sit out there the whole time. I'm very sorry, but I've got to carry it over until I get my question answered. Anything else for the order? With that, let's adjourn the committee. Thank you.
Good bill, Paul. Good bill, Paul.
With that, let's adjourn the committee. Thank you.